Hello and welcome to the RCGP Essential Knowledge Updates podcast. My name is Dr. Thomas Round. I'm a GP in London and also the RCGP EKU Clinical Fellow. And today I'm talking to colleague Professor Carolyn Chu Graham from University of Kiel and a Manchester GP. And we're talking about IBS, irritable bowel syndrome.
Hi, thank you. So I've got a clinical interest in persistent physical symptoms, which includes IBS, and have done some research in the past, although it's not my main area of expertise in terms of research.
And today we're talking about IBS, which is a common clinical condition which all of us as GPs will see very often. Maybe it's worth thinking at the beginning about what do we mean by IBS?
So according to the NICE guideline, IBS, as you say, is chronic, it's relaxing, and it's often a lifelong disorder. And it's characterised by the presence of abdominal pain or discomfort, and may be accompanied by a change in bowel habits, which can be constipation or diarrhoea, or a mixture of both. People also complain of abdominal distension, and they often describe that as bloating. Symptoms can overlap with other gastrointestinal disorders such as non-ulcer dyspepsia, celiac disease, and people with IBS, as we know as GPs, Thomas, can present with a variety of symptoms. Sometimes people feel quite sensitive about them. It's quite stigmatising. They may have problems with continence. And so it takes really sensitive questioning to try and get people to talk about these symptoms.
As I say, such a common problem. I think, is it something between 10 and 20% of the population are
it
affected?
It is, yeah. And it tends to affect women more than men and tends to present commonly between the ages of 20 and 30, but it can present in older people. Now, that's quite tricky for us as GPs because it's important for us to make sure we're not missing a significant diagnosis that needs a different sort of treatment and investigation. So we perhaps should be a little bit cautious about labelling somebody as having IBS who's an older person without some investigation.
I totally agree. So, I mean, my research interests at King's College, I look at early cancer research. So often these symptoms can overlap, can't they, initially? So I think the key role of us as primary care and GPs is thinking about the diagnostic possibilities, not labelling someone as IBS until we're pretty sure that we think it is IBS.
Absolutely. And NICE have got some really good guidance around this. And they suggest that somebody should have symptoms for at least 6 months. And they talk about an ABC, so abdominal pain or discomfort, bloating and a change in bowel habits. But as you say, those aren't diagnostic because actually in some people they could represent inflammatory bowel disorders, could represent cancer, diverticular disease. We used to talk about IBS being a diagnosis of exclusion. I'm going to talk about some of the investigations later. But I think it's also important to alert the patient in front of you to the fact that you might be thinking about IBS. So it's not seen as we've done all these investigations and everything's negative. It must be IBS rather than you're describing some symptoms of IBS. We may need to do some investigations and we can do that. You know, we may find these investigations are normal and I think this is IBS. So selling it in a more positive way rather than, oh, well, you know, done everything, it must be.
Yeah, I think that's a real challenge for us, isn't it? I mean, it's so common, as you say, just thinking of the symptom iceberg, which we're so used to in primary care, how common abdominal pain is, bloating is, really common at a population prevalence and also consulting us in general practice. And then thinking about when do we need to do diagnostic testing and investigations.
Yeah, and NICE suggests that actually we should be doing some other investigations. So even when somebody presents with the sort of classic symptoms of altered stool passage, abdominal bloating, symptoms that may be worse by eating, mucus, those again can indicate more significant pathology. Therefore, we should be doing a full blood count, an ESR or plasma viscosity, C-reactive protein, checking for celiac disease. And I think a lot of GPs are also put in their thyroid function. Occasionally somebody may present with thyrotoxicosis and symptoms of IBS. We'd probably also do hematinics. And many of us would also consider fecal calprotectin if we're thinking about an inflammatory process, a FIT test in older people. And if someone's got upper abdominal symptoms, then the Helicobacter, depending on the age of the patient, I think.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. Obviously, it's depending on where we are and that first patient coming in, you know, having a first consultation with these issues. I think most of it do good history taking, probably a lot of things. It might be remote, it might be a telephone consultation, whether if there's a concern, maybe bringing them in for a physical examination if required and then doing those tests like you mentioned.
I think it's really important that you've mentioned the change to remote consulting. So often people will send in an online query talking about change in bowel habits. And so whereas in the past we would do a history examination, have a discussion about investigations needed, prime people to the fact that we think this might be IBS, think your investigations will be normal. We're doing things the other way around in a sense, certainly in my practice. So somebody, certainly younger person who says, I've got a change in bowel habit, I've got bloating. They talk about, you know, maybe say 2 months, then we will often do the blood test first and then bring them in. So they've got the blood test results and then, you know, the FIT or the fecal calprotectin, and then we see them and examine them. And I'm not sure when it's a remote consultation and we say we're going to organise blood tests, we don't have that discussion about, I think these tests are going to be normal. And so I think it has altered the dynamic. And I think what we write in that response to their online query is really important.
Absolutely. And, you know, using text messaging and other functions, aren't we now? I think similar to yourself, maybe if people, it's a young person, first consultation, talking about bloating without red flags, without rectal bleeding, we might just go straight to having investigations.
Yeah. And I think people will sometimes write in, again, it's online queries, first contact, requesting scans, requesting, particularly if they say I've got family history of bowel cancer, I want a colonoscopy. Then I think we have to remember what NICE say, that actually those sort of investigations aren't needed. We do the basic investigations first and we have a face-to-face discussion with the patient.
Yeah, I think that's important. I think I'm moving to more of a hybrid model, seeing a lot more people face-to-face. I think kind of coming out a little bit of the pandemic, obviously we've got to be mindful of that as well and the different routes into general practice. So yeah, maybe we've got that patient then, we've seen them, we've done an assessment either remotely or face-to-face. We've done some initial tests. Worth just thinking about, you mentioned calprotectin and FIT test. So as I understand it, calprotectin we'd probably use in that more younger population. I think it's validated up to 50 or 60, if I'm right. I think it's more of a younger population. What's FIT test, as I understand, not valid in children, but can be any adult, you can potentially use a FIT test.
Yeah, absolutely. And I suppose I would avoid using the FIT test less than 35, and there's probably no evidence for that, but I just think it's very unlikely that somebody, unless they've got a strong family history, they've got polyps, it's very unlikely they're going to have a bowel cancer. Let's think of IBS as a working diagnosis. Let's do the basics first.
That's a really good question. I think there's actually research going into that, because we are, interestingly, as I look at cancer, we are seeing an increased rate, particularly in bowel cancer in younger people, interestingly enough, you know, Bowel Babe and the other people who, you know, in their 30s. So always at the back of your mind, I guess if things aren't getting better, changes, you know, and the safety netting is so important wherever we are with these cases, even if we think we've got a diagnostic label, just to safety net. Because of course, over time, if we're saying 10% of people have IBS, 20% have IBS, a number of those people will go on just to get bowel cancer.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Just because somebody's got a diagnosis of IBS in the notes, if they present with new symptoms, it's important to take them seriously, isn't it? And investigate, not say, oh, it must be your IBS.
We call that diagnostic overshadowing if people are interested. So I think there's quite a lot of people who do research into that. But I'm kind of very keen that, yeah, you look at something, I think a fresh pair of eyes can be helpful as well, you know, if people have IBS and then things change. Then we've got that patient, we've done the tests, they've done a calprotectin and it's come back as normal. We then go through the results and then discuss IBS with them.
You know, as we do in primary care, we take a person-centred approach. So finding out what their worries are, why they consulted in the first place. We talk about ICE, ideas, concerns, expectations. What have they tried already? Do they have other persistent physical symptoms? So people with IBS may have fibromyalgia, chronic fatigue syndrome, TMJ dysfunction. They often link together. How do people understand those conditions? How do they manage them? People bringing experiences from family or friends, is there a family history of bowel cancer and therefore worry about whether that's what they've got? And I guess also, what have they read on Google Doc? What have they read on the internet? Mm-hmm. What were they expecting when they made that first consultation? What are they expecting in subsequent consultations? And what are they expecting in terms of management?
Yeah, so I guess with the IBS, it's that symptom-based approach, isn't it? And then we can, from the literature, it doesn't come up in my primary care record. I try to label someone as IBS-C, but it just gives IBS. So obviously we have IBS constipation, IBS diarrhea, don't we? IBS-D, IBS-C, and then standard IBS mixed, both.
Yeah, we do. And you know, most people, I think, have a combination and it can vary across the week, across the month, through their life. So often their management will vary as to whereabouts they are in that spectrum. But the basic advice that we should be giving is very basic information about diet and nutrition. So regular meals, taking time to eat over them, avoiding missing meals, drinking plenty, restricting tea and coffee, restricting alcohol, restricting fizzy drinks. So all the sort of lifestyle advice, lifestyle in inverted commas, that we ought to be giving. I direct people to the NHS website about irritable bowel, really good information. I think then we need to talk to them about fibre. And, you know, absolutely, sometimes people need more fibre, but often people need less fibre, particularly avoiding the bran-based fibre foods. And there is evidence that you should limit your fruit intake. But then if you do that, what about your vitamins? What about your five a day? People who've got diarrhoea should avoid alcohol. And as I've said, the wind and bloating, it's often more fibre makes that worse, so regulate that. But what I say to people, there isn't a standard diet, that it's often trial and error, and see what makes your symptoms worse, see what improves your symptoms, but have a look to make sure that your diet is reasonable and balanced. And people will ask, well, can I see a dietitian? And certainly where I work, Thomas, the answer is no. So it always worries me that then people go off and see nutritionists and get told they've got candida and have all sorts of treatments suggested to them.
Yes, I guess in my area it's quite hard to see a community dietitian for IBS, so I totally agree. Yeah, I advise people to keep a food diary just to see if there's any kind of triggers, and I think the patient being activated and their self-management is so important with this chronic long-term condition, which can be actually in some people quite difficult to manage. It can be quite debilitating.
And particularly when the diarrhea is the predominant feature, often people feel lack of confidence in going out, they may get caught short, they may become incontinent or get staining, they may worry that they smell, and that it affects the whole life. And so if they have got the diarrhea predominance, I think what we can do in primary care is advise as well as about diet and making sure they're not taking too much fibre, but also we can prescribe loperamide, or we can ask people to buy loperamide over the counter and take that to control the diarrhea. And that is quite a simple intervention which actually can be quite helpful.
And then obviously people can buy buscopan or mebeverine over the counter, fibre gel as well, as I understand that can be quite helpful if people have more constipation, IBS.
Yeah, and then, you know, it's a decision between the GP and the patient, and often the practice or the, I was going to say commissioning guidelines, but PCN guidance on prescribing. Can we prescribe that, or do we advise people to get it over the counter? But I always say to people, it's trial and error. So buscopan can work wonderfully for some people, but doesn't work at all for others. So try not to sell it as a, this will help, but this is worth trying. There's mixed evidence about it.
A bit like how we might also approach chronic pain.
Exactly. I mean, I think I always say to people with IBS, this is what I think it is. We've excluded some other symptoms. This is the website to have a look at. What I need to emphasise is that I can't cure it, but you can take control of it. You can manage it. And a lot of it is trial and error, and I'm here to support you through that.
That's really helpful. Thank you. Is there some evidence for CBT type interventions?
There is, but before we move on to CBT, there's also probiotics. Again, sometimes they help people. So I'll say to somebody, well, try it for 4 weeks. If it helps, great. If it doesn't, don't continue. There's a FODMAP diet, and there's information on the NHS website.
Yeah.
And that's about avoiding the sort of fermentable oligosaccharides. Also nice suggests that you can try amitriptyline or nortriptyline. So low-dose tricyclic antidepressant. Sometimes, however, people really feel that the side effects of sedation and dry mouth outweigh the benefits. NICE also suggests that you can try SSRIs, but actually they're not licensed for that. And then NICE goes on to suggest the psychological interventions. I suppose I feel that actually the next NICE guideline ought to suggest the psychological interventions first.
Yes.
There is evidence for CBT. There is evidence for hypnotherapy. So NICE say people who've not responded to pharmacological treatments for 12 months, as I say, my suggestion would be actually they should try that first. It's all part of self-management. And if you can get them seen by NHS talking therapists, do some CBT, then that could be helpful. I think, though, it's really important to say to people, I'm not referring you to NHS talking therapists because I think your symptoms are all in the mind. I'm referring you because your symptoms are real, they're bothering you, and the talking therapies may be able to help you manage your symptoms better.
And I guess also important to look for concomitant stress and depression in some of these patients. And as you said, fibromyalgia or other chronic pain syndromes.
Absolutely. And then again, if somebody does have depression or anxiety, then and you say you want to prescribe a SSRI antidepressant, then again, you're saying you're prescribing it for the depression or for the anxiety, not because I think your pain or your bloating is all in your mind.
Yeah, the way I talk about the tricyclics like amitriptyline or nortriptyline is working on your pain receptors. We don't use them for depression anymore, but we use them commonly for people with chronic pain. And I guess maybe one of the side effects of the tricyclics, especially if you're maybe having diarrhea, I think it can constipate some people.
Actually,
that can be one of the potentially helpful side effects if someone's having a lot of loose stools.
Actually, that's a good selling point, isn't it? I hadn't thought about that.
And I think also buscopan is similar. It's got a reduction in bloating, gas, but also can affect bowel function. I think you rightly say it's trial and error, isn't it? It's keeping a diary maybe of symptoms, empowering patients to try and self-manage this long-term condition, which can flare up. You know, often the flare-ups can be stress, can't they, related exams or other stressful life events.
Yeah, and people recognise that. So they will often contact us and say, I'm having a flare from my IBS. But again, it's coming back to what we said earlier. just check those symptoms out, because just because you've had IBS in the past, you've now got new symptoms. Are they the same symptoms? Are they IBS? Do we need to do any other investigations? And I suppose the older somebody gets, the more likely I am to say,
yeah, totally.
Actually, you know, we need to investigate this. Let's not just put it down to your IBS.
Yes, I'd be very keen for trainees listening to this thing, like, actually, fresh pair of eyes, have a look when the last investigations were, reassess the patient and get a good history, just see if anything subtle has changed, weight loss, other features that could point you more towards thinking of pathology not to miss. Yeah. So IBD, as you say, I always do a celiac test on these patients. I think I've picked up one in 10 years, but it's an important diagnosis not to miss.
Yes, and I do that at the start. And I had a patient a few weeks ago, and we couldn't decide whether they'd had celiac screen before. I did it again, and then we went down through the notes. I thought, oh, they have had it before. And I thought, well, should I still do it? And I ticked the box and they were going to have it anyway. But I don't know what the evidence is. If they've had it done, you know, 5 years ago, do you redo it?
That's a good question. I think you can develop it. I think it's the same for any testing we're doing. It's at that point in time, a bit like also fit testing at that point in time. Yeah, going back to the fit test, most of us now are probably fully implementing this into primary care. It's actually a really good rule out test. So it's got a negative predictive value of above 99% for cancer. So you can be pretty confident if someone's got a negative fit that they don't have cancer. And actually the PPV is actually better than symptoms. I think the PPV, if you test positive, is about 15 to 20%, which is actually better than red flag symptoms. So it's actually a really good test to use.
Yeah, I think calprotectin. Nice talk about the red flag symptoms. So, you know, a combination. If somebody's got new symptoms, then you do a fit test and it's positive, you know, please act on it.
Yeah. So I guess the key thing is, you know, the gold standard is a colonoscopy, and some people might be required if we're concerned. And so, the calprotectin, as well, as I understand, I know less research about that, but I think it's quite a good rule out test. So if you've got a negative calprotectin, it's quite good. But obviously you can have lots of false positives. I guess the other thing to think about with a good history is travel history. Is there any diarrheal infection risk? Because that can put up calprotectin inflammatory marker. Do we also need to think about doing microscopy type test, or if there's any travel history or other history there?
Yeah, certainly if somebody presents for the first time with diarrhea, you would do a stool specimen, wouldn't you, for culture? And as you say, ask about travel.
There was one trial I also saw quite, I think it was a couple of years ago now, it's a randomized trial of using ondansetron in IBS with diarrhea. So that's anti-sickness medication, which most of us might use sometimes in palliative care or other settings. And actually it did find that could be quite effective in an RCT for reducing diarrhea. Again, it's off license, but it might come in future guidelines. I think there's more research required in that area.
Oh, that's interesting. Thank you. I think it's also worth mentioning that people will often seek other forms of therapy because the NHS has let them down as they perceive it. So, you know, they go for acupuncture or reflexology, biofeedback, Chinese medicines, they go to Holland and Barrett. And I say to people, well, if it works for you, that's fine. You know, there's no evidence, but I don't try and dissuade people if they found something that works for them. What worries me is that it's people who have got the resources to seek those private forms of care. You know, it's another example, isn't it, of the inverse care law, that there will be people who don't have resources financially to go and seek out alternative therapies that struggle on with their symptoms.
Yeah, and also, as you say, the difficulty in dietitians. So, you know, if you've got money, you could potentially see a dietitian privately. Also, that I guess the FODMAP diet, I do sometimes direct people to it. I say I can't fully give advice because I'm not a dietitian. Actually, interesting, my mother's got quite bad IBS. So she downloaded the Monash University FODMAP app, which has revolutionized her life. She can't talk about this more highly enough. As you say, got related to stress and anxiety, but it was actually stopping her traveling with loose stools. But actually following the FODMAP with the app and a little bit of dietitian advice has revolutionized her life. So it can really work. So I think there's kind of apps and things, but that's, you know, my mum's white and educated and she was a teacher. So you've got to think about all health inequalities. How can we help make some of these interventions accessible to other members of the community?
Yeah, that demands digital literacy, health literacy, money, doesn't it? Yeah. Which does exclude some vulnerable groups.
So I guess in summary from our discussion, sort of top tips then, Carolyn, into practice.
So I think, as with all patients presenting symptoms, believe people's symptoms. Make sure you take a really good history. Try and make a positive diagnosis. If you think this is IBS, check out their symptoms. Food diary, really good if people are willing to do it. Focused examination, focused investigations, prefacing them if possible with, I think these are going to be normal, but we'll do them to make sure everything's okay. Giving the diagnosis in a positive way. And reflecting that it is a long-term condition and that it's, I'd say it's the responsibility of the patients, but actually saying to a patient, there's a lot you can do yourself to manage these symptoms. I can support you. There are some things I can prescribe, but I can't tell you whether they'll help. And do feel free to come back. It's really important if your symptoms change, come back, because things can change, things can develop. We need to make sure we don't just say, this is IBS for the rest of your life.
Exactly. And as we've said, think about when investigations have been done. Do they need to be redone? Always at the back of your mind, safety netting, thinking about other pathology as well.
Absolutely. And it's about what we do in general practice. It's what we do well. We develop relationships with patients. We try and offer continuity of care. We try and see the clinician and the patient working together to try different management options to see which works best for the individual.
That's great. Thank you. And thanks, Carolyn, for your really great insights and discussion today. It was really helpful. Thank you.
Thank you very much for inviting me, Thomas.
Thank you. And thanks for listening to RCGP Essential Knowledge Updates podcast. I'm Dr. Thomas Round. And thank you for listening.